The light of day rolls back as the tide rolls in. The moon shines wan, 'tis a night for sin. Best watch out for the highwayman, says Thomas to his younger kin. The carriage is in good repair. We breathe the salty ocean air. Off we go to the poet's lair, situated in the town of Ayr. Thomas and John Ingerven, young brothers from Maybole in the county of Ayrshire, Scotland, are travelling to the town of Ayr to celebrate Robert Burns's day in his birthplace in an adjacent community called Alloway. Robbie's ascendancy from obscure local farm life in 1786 to becoming eventually National Poet of Scotland has excited the local youth in the communities in South Ayrshire. A dashing young idol has been created. A myth was born. The brothers leave late afternoon on Robbie Burns Day, January 25th, 1823, 25 years after the poet's death. Let's follow the brothers to find the poet behind the myth and the man behind the poet. To while away the early evening, Thomas and John recite poems by Robert Burns as tandem horses pulling their carriage keep time. Thomas hums a continuing drone. The pole metal chains on the harness scrape and jangle. The horses... This mobile percussion section has marked the rhythm during the 2 hours of travel from the town of Maybole to Ayr. John recites A Fond Kiss by Robbie Burns. The carriage percussion continues, builds progressively to a crescendo, then fades gradually in Doppler effect as time squeezes a shrinking space between a lurking observer and the passing carriage. Then space expands to fill the hole left by sound as it evaporates. The carriage passes a masked figure in the shadows at the edge of a nearby forest. The passing carriage bound for Ayr excites a brigand waiting there behind a thicket. The highwayman dons a mask and spurs his mount into spirited gallop. The animal explodes in a sudden burst, flattening leaves on the low-growing underbrush. It weaves between trees, then in a series of hurdles, in leaps, in bounds, clearing low shrubs. Horse and rider join in chase, for the advancing carriage rapidly gaining ground on the travellers. The brothers, soon aware of growing perils coming near, incite their steeds to desperate flight. Their horses tumble forward on uneven terrain, and thus begins a pursuit in failing daylight, a pursuit which must result in blood on the roadway and loss of life. The rampaging marauder pulls abreast of the carriage. "Stand and deliver," yells the brigand, brandishing his pistol. Fear and frenzy then ensue as the highwayman does pursue the victims. Now confused in a game which neither party dares to lose, for life itself is on the line. Whose life will it be, yours or mine? Each must decide. The brigand then with malign intent whips his horse without relent. Through savage force and blind ambition, fueled by headstrong stiff volition, he strikes again the angry horse, acts for which there's no remorse and no time to repent. His mount issues a warning of his decision to rebel against the tyranny of its rider, snorts, bucks, then at full gallop stops abrupt, propelling its villainous master, now become a missile airborne, flung over the animal, the body catapulting air twice before it hits the wheel of the carriage and then to earth, there to lay immobile in an inglorious heap. The highwayman's neck snaps on contact when his head hits the ground. Death is swift. It does not wait. The young men halt to view the remains of the interloper. They dismount from the carriage and watch the newly liberated horse disappear on the gallop into deepening night. The lifeless corpse laying there reveals nothing of the past of the young man whose energy and bold ambition held a hope for his kin, until desperation and impatience took him from apprenticeship as wheelwright to the path of larceny on the many byroads of Ayrshire. Bent over the body of the highwayman, Thomas, the elder brother, pulls back the makeshift mask and announces, "I know this man. 'Tis Jacob, bastard son of Kentish of Killeen Castle, in adulterous union with Karen Kilcully, Irish washerwoman in his employ, a very strange, bewildered boy, a ne'er-do-well if e'er I saw, who now has gone beyond the law. But no time to stay in sad reflection, since night descends in all directions. A few more leagues, we'll cross the bridge and find us lodgings for the night. No doubt there'll be much sorrow among the brigand's kin when his empty horse arrives tomorrow without him." Thomas and John remount the carriage, and without a second thought, they resume their journey. With night fast approaching, what could they do? Perhaps the highwayman had confederates in the vicinity. Best leave the scene without delay. In mere minutes, they see flickering lights from lamps and smoke rising from a clearing on the horizon on the other side of a watercourse. Emotionally shaken and in some despair, they cross the river at the new bridge of Ayr. Thomas and John reach their destination at the carriage inn at the edge of the town of Ayr, and spend an agitated night recalling the recent fright, their frenzied flight, and the awful destiny of the highwayman. Younger brother John will long recall this scene in some as yet far off, unanticipated tomorrow. The scene, a riderless horse returning home at another time and in warmer climes, this scene will ever haunt his constant, fevered dreams. A raucous, joyous throng of revelers, 50 or more, are gathered there in high spirits. A woman elegantly attired greets the brothers at the door. Banquet hall setting, appropriate sounds. "Good evening, young man. May I inquire the reasons for your presence here tonight?" "Good evening to you, Madame," Thomas replies. "We come to celebrate the poet of Alloway. This certificate will attest Ingarvan episode 2, a special celebration at the carriage inn." A joyous, raucous throng of revelers, 50 or more, are gathered there in high spirits. A woman elegantly attired greets the brothers at the door. "Good evening, young men. May I inquire the reason for your presence here tonight?" "Good evening to you, madame," Thomas replies. "We come to celebrate the poet of Alloway. This certificate will attest to my bona fides. I am, madame, Thomas Ingarvan, engineer, certified by royal charter, and this younger brother John, duly certified millwright and wheelwright, is my companion here tonight. We hold the Bard of Ayr in very high regard." "Enter, lads," she does reply, and she points to an area designed for the hoi polloi. Well armed, whiskey in hand, Thomas and John seat themselves and await the proceedings of the Robbie Burns encomium. The banquet room fills to the 50-seat capacity with eminent personnages, rich and renowned from Ayrshire to Glasgow. A most memorable evening begins. The master of ceremonies then steps to the dais and reads the names of prominent families in attendance. Some of the benefactors of the poet are known also for their association with the traffic of slaves from Africa to the Caribbean. The roll call, funereal, solemn, as in a dirge, intones the names of underwriters, promoters, and supporters in a commerce to create and propagate human misery on a grand and inglorious scale, for the profit, the vanity, and the glory of a few, a brutally cynical and barbaric industry of nation-building fueled by greed and demented economic logic. The reading of the list of families supporting the slave trade commences. Graham, James, Douglas, Dr. Patrick, and Jane. Kennedy, Quinton, Thomas, and William. Ferguson, Charles, and Sir Adam. Montgomery, Charles, Hamilton, Robert, and John. Hunter, William and James. Peterson, John. Roselle. Each name receives the warm acknowledgement of the assembly. 15 of Robert Burns's poems then are put in a basket, and guests invited to reach into the basket, pick a poem at random, step to a podium at the front of the room, and read it to the assembled Burnsophiles. The reader then reaches for a bottle of whiskey, pours himself a shot, bolts the whiskey down in a single gulp to great applause from the assembly. The poems. Ah, woe is me, my mother dear. The gloomy night is gathering fast. Holy Willie's prayer. A bottle and a friend. Prayer under pressure of violent anguish to a red-red rose. They read, then drink the whiskey and regain their seats for the applause of the invited guests. John Ingarvan steps up to the dais, picks a poem and reads To a Kiss, and gulps a shot of whiskey. His rendition meets with the approval of the gathering so well that he's invited to read a second poem. He reaches in and picks The Lad That Made the Bed to Me. He's again showered with applause, drinks, and picks a third time To a Rose. The spirits that he's imbibing with each reading release him from any remaining constraints. He now assumes that all the world's a stage and delivers up convincingly, Will ye go to the Indies, my Mary? To the uproarious approbation of the throng, he gulps again the whiskey, and with unsteady gait, he regains his seat to sustained and continuing applause. The eyes of all the guests turn to a reader now coming to the dais. He stands out from other celebrants by the vestments that he wears. Thomas Clarkson, evangelist and abolitionist, is among the notables here tonight, visiting churches in a crusade across the country to spread the word of God into an unconcerned community. Thomas Clarkson, visiting vicar, is last to read and demonstrates his ability to lead his flock among the lesser-traveled paths of righteousness. He reads tonight The Slave's Lament with such a powerful intent, his voice quivering with fervor. Showing some wisdom in the ways of the world, the preacher and pamphleteer then introduces his audience to some material that he publishes, religious tracts through which he engages the curiosity of the Burnsophile celebrants. Drumming up his audience tonight for his sermon tomorrow, January 25th, he says, This is not the time, nor indeed is it the place, to probe in any detail the shame and great disgrace of Robert Burns in the tear-filled eyes of God, he continues. At the kirk on the morrow, many will come to hear the dictates of the Lord, come to feel the passion he affords, those who accept his words and direct their actions to correct their errors. Clarkson regains his seat. Confusion spreads among the assembly. The Brotherhood of Burns is perplexed. To quell the disarray, one of the distinguished guests, one of the organizers of the Burns evening, reintroduces a semblance of order, initiating a chorus of Auld Lang Syne. The celebrants pick up the song, at first tentatively, then with increasing gusto. Clarkson exits the building amid a smattering of grumbles and jeers. The evangelist now departed. The Burns night agenda continues with the Selkirk grace. A skirl of bagpipes followed by a bevy of young beauties skirted in Kennedy tartan, announced the arrival of the haggis. Ingarvan, Episode 3, Robbie Burns Day at Church. Sunday morning service, January 25th, 1823, begins under gray skies. The local pastor addresses the congregation, this Sunday much more numerous than usual. The pamphlets distributing notice of this meeting by the visiting prelate have reaped rich rewards. The local pastor introduces Thomas Clarkson, saying, "We have the distinct pleasure to welcome Pastor Thomas Clarkson to our church today. We ask the Lord to bless his servant, Thomas, and grant to him the wisdom to reach new hearts in his service, a service especially needed in these troubled times, where greed and hedonism, where lust for money and lust for carnal pleasure abound in all corners of the earth." Sunday morn at the kirk, the abolitionist's point of view puts a fulsome congregation in the pew to hear Thomas Clarkson bear witness to moral decay in the nation. Today he will pronounce on matters of great import, slavery and fornication. A muted organ whispers, distributing soothing tremolo waves throughout the house of God, opening the minds of the congregation, preparing the psychological terrain for the appeal to clear the mind of things mundane and lift their spirits to lofty heights of salvation through Jesus Christ, our Lord. "Amen," replies the congregation. The pastor, moving to the podium, raises his right hand with the Bible over his balding head and with a steady, confident air asserts, "The Lord Almighty is my sword. As I go into battle here today in Bonnie Air, I will not yield, since his word is my buckler and this Bible is my shield." The pastor continues, "Nary an empty pew today. God's blessing today unto you I bestow. Many faces that I here recognize, still in agonies from an excess of strong drink and debauchery from the function for the fornicator Robert Burns. Although a local lad and prideful are we, still we must not condone the errors that he has shown to all humanity. His conduct we must deplore from air to every distant shore, and caution we must bring to temper the desire to satisfy every appetite and quench each burning fire of perfidious passion and stubborn craven lechery. The evidence below will very clearly show what everyone should know about our late lamented poet, our dear departed beau." He continues, "Brother Cecil, long-term deacon of this church for lo these many years, has more than a passing knowledge of Robert Burns. He will now recount for us the sorry tale of the late poet's travails, his amorous entanglements, and his early demise." The deacon steps to the lectern and addresses the conversation. "I knew Robert Burns when he was a young lad in Alloway. His parents were tenant farmers working on several properties in the area. He studied under the tutelage of his father while working as a labourer with him from the age of 12. His father passed away, leaving the family of 7 children with no resources. Robert was then 24 years old. He tried with little success to keep farming, and moved to Mossgiel, a nearby community. A handsome young man he was, and fond of the women. His attraction to women drove him to write songs and poems for the many objects of his infatuations. He soon found himself hopelessly entangled with several of the local women at a time. His continuing loose, immoral behavior earned him a rebuke from the church. He had a child with his mother's servant, and soon learned that his future wife, Jean Armour, was pregnant with twins. With no economic prospect and growing responsibilities, he was offered and accepted a job of bookkeeper's and assistant slave master from an Ayrshire doctor who owned a sugar plantation in Port Antonio, Jamaica. Shortly before leaving for Jamaica, Burns got word that the poetry that he had sent to a publisher had been accepted, and his collection of poems chiefly in the Scottish dialect, launched his literary career. Robbie Burns then cancelled his trip to Jamaica. He wrote of this decision, saying, "I had taken the last farewell of my few friends. My chest was on the road to Greenock. I had composed my last songs I should measure in Scotland. The gloomy night is gathering fast." The deacon continues, "Robert Burns died of rheumatic fever at the age of 36, leaving many, alas, broken-hearted, having sired 13 children in his short life." The deacon walks away from the lectern and regains his seat. Charles Clarkson resumes his sermon, saying, "Brother Cecil has mentioned the rebuke imposed on Robbie Burns by the Church of Scotland. I now read from the article of rebuke from a compendium of the laws of the Church of Scotland. I read, by the Act of Assembly, August 10, 1648, fornicators are to make profession of their repentance 3 several Sundays, who are guilty of a relapse therein, 6 Sabbaths, who are guilty of a trelapse therein, 26 Sabbaths, who are guilty of a quadrelapse, 3/4 of a year in all sackcloth, and are first to appear before the presbytery before confessing their sins there." Charles Clarkson walks away from the pulpit and continues his sermon, looking directly out into the church, while slowly, deliberately leaning forward, scanning the congregation with a penetrating sweep from left to right, pointing and wagging the index finger of his right hand, he pronounces, "Of libido, Robert Burns was suffused. Of fornication, justly he was accused and found in contravention of church law." A collective murmur consisting of indistinct mumbles spreads among the congregation. Clarkson calls the congregation to attention. He continues to hector his captive flock. "Now, on the matters of African slave, their capture, their sequestration, and the savagery of their oppression, to that I must recount a story which on all accounts bestows no glory on he who would exercise tyrannical control over another life. To chronicle the sad event is to make the human heart lament the moral state of any true Christian soul." He redoubles his litany. "If the unrepentant fornicator is by God and church condemned to the antechambers of everlasting fire, the deepest hole with the hottest coals is the destiny reserved for enslavers who give their souls to the devil." Thomas Clarkson reaches for one of the pamphlets, steps back from the pulpit, and reads an account of a tragedy at sea in 1781. He reads, "The slave ship Zong departed the coast of Africa on the 6th of September, 1781, with 470 slaves. Since this human chattel was such a valuable commodity at the time, many captains took on more slaves than their ship could accommodate in order to maximize profits. The Zong's captain, Luke Collingwood, overloaded his ship with slaves, and by the 27th of November, many of them had begun to die from disease and malnutrition. The Zong then sailed in an area in the mid-Atlantic known as the doldrums, because of periods of little or no wind. As the ship sat stranded, sickness caused the deaths of 7 of the 17 crew members and over 50 slaves. Increasingly desperate, Collingwood decided to jettison some of the cargo in order to save the ship and provide the ship's owners the opportunity to claim the loss on their insurance. Over the next week, the remaining crew members threw 132 slaves who were sick and dying over the side. Another 10 slaves threw themselves overboard in what Collingwood later described as an act of defiance. Upon the Zong's arrival in Jamaica, James Gregson, the ship's owner, filed an insurance claim for their loss. Gregson argued that the Zong did not have enough water to sustain both crew and the human commodities. The insurance underwriter, Thomas Gilbert, disputed the claim, citing that the Zong had 420 gallons of water aboard, when she was inventoried in Jamaica. Despite this, the Jamaican court in 1782 found in favor of the owners. Publicity surrounding the Zong massacre and the first case led William Murray, the Earl of Mansfield, and the Lord Chief Justice of the King's Bench, the highest court in Great Britain, to order a second trial. Mansfield presided and ruled in favor of the insurers. He also held that the cargo had been poorly managed, as the captain should have made a suitable allowance of water for each slave. Later attempts to have criminal charges brought against the captain, crew, and the owners were unsuccessful. Great Britain's Solicitor General Justice John Lee, however, refused to take up the criminal charges, claiming, "What is this claim that human people have been thrown overboard? This is a case of chattels, our goods. Blacks are goods and property. It is madness to accuse these well-serving honorable men of murder." Those who were responsible for the Zong massacre were never brought to justice. Reading this sad account, indignity begins to mount in the abolitionist. "Zong," he moans. "Zong, accursed vessel," he intones. "Vessel, governed by vassals of the devil. Zong, epitome of evil. Zong." Overwrought with such great emotion, and so devout in his devotion to his lord, the prelate's knees buckle. He wobbles briefly, then faints on the spot. Ingarvan, Episode 4, A Business Proposition. Two medical doctors among the congregants respond to the fallen preacher and quickly diagnose his condition. "Neurasthenia, we suppose, brought on by excessive nervous disturbations, we propose. There's anxiety and vexatious scruples in his soul. Laudanum, we prescribe. Tincture of opium he must imbibe to re-establish equilibrium in his soul." Amid general confusion and concern, the service comes to a close as the resident pastor gives thanks to the visiting prelate, reassuring the congregation that God's servant, Thomas Clarkson, has regained all his faculties and is now comfortably seated in the vestry and under the care of two local doctors. The organist then induces calm, playing "Eternal Father, Strong to Save, O hear us when we call to thee for those in peril on the sea," as ushers lead the congregation to the exit, restoring order to the untimely closure of the evangelist's crusade to win souls in support of the abolition of slavery. The congregation disperses slowly, little clutches gathering outside to discuss the matters they have recently witnessed. Unease about a past moral rebuke by church authorities, merited by a local poet, crimes at sea on a ship named Zong, and an abolitionist overcome by intense and excessive emotion. Three men from the table of dignitaries at last night's tribute to Robbie Burns approach the brothers outside the church. One of the men initiates a conversation. Archibald Kennedy of Culzean, Marquess of Ailsa, says, "Young man, what do you make of the sad turn events to which we were witness? The abolitionist has surely lost his mind. He must be non compos mentis." He continues, "The Holy Bible shows ample evidence that the good Lord accepts and defends the subjugation of lesser mortals. And doth our nation's law not allow and approve the use of human labor for the betterment of all mankind, and to the greater glory of our nation and of our God?" He continues, "As for the sanction the church imposes on the poet, better to send posies composed of red, red roses to the victims than to try and check the inordinate amorous trances when the lecher advances under the hypnotic drive of carnal appetites." He continues, "As for the sanction the church imposes on the poet, better to send posies composed of red, red roses to the victims than to try to check the inordinate amorous trances when the lecher advances under the hypnotic drive of carnal appetite. He continues, "We're here to extend an invitation to you to consider using your skills, your technical abilities, and your youth in the service of the nation and to your own material advances. The path not taken by Robbie Burns remains available to young men like you. Last night you had an endearing presence of the Carrigan. Your poise, your intelligence, your social skills, and your excellent credentials point to your potential to succeed in whatever you undertake. All these elements make of you attractive candidates for employment in an exciting area of the world, the Caribbean, where many of our neighbors in the county of Ayrshire have invested and gained enormous returns from their investment in the past century." Robbie Burns was destined for Jamaica before literary success interrupted his journey. Unless you have some hidden skill, your youth promises you no such alternative for rapid escape from the mediocrity of hard work with little financial gain. Thomas replies, "My lord, the path not taken by Robbie Burns remains available to young men like you. How should we understand these words?" Lord Kennedy of Killeen replies, "Young lad, when adventure calls and good fortune falls in your path, it is best to heed the call, lest misfortune should befall you in some far-off morrow and find you in greater need." He continues, "For a century even more, men have left old Scotia's shore to initiate, then sustain, the economic reign of mighty sugar cane. Conditions now dictate that the market accommodate to these facts. In the age of slavery, it is late. Plantation soon will fail. Abolitionists will prevail. For sugar to survive, labor must be free, and African people we must deprive of liberty. What says the young poet, your brother, beside you?" John Ingervan now replies, "If sugar, the reigning king, declines, what then defines the grandeur of Britain's claim to profit from the vast domains of empire in the Indies?" Lord Kennedy replies, "The young poet indeed displays a precocious flair beyond his age and shows a power of prescience to assay on matters of consequence in the economic destinies of empires and of nature. Young poet, soon King Sugar will be dead. Who will lead us in his stead? Queen Coffee. The sugar lands exhausted, we now cultivate Queen Coffee on lands of higher elevation. Few workers she requires. We warm her over fires to generate, then penetrate her subtle warm desires. If King Sugar is dead, long live the Queen." He continues, "I reiterate and elaborate. The path not taken by Robbie Burns remains wide open for young men such as you." He continues, "As we speak, I can project vacancies for posts in the parishes of Clarendon, St. Anne, and St. Thomas on the island of Jamaica in the near future as we diversify from sugar plantation to coffee production. We plantation owners in Scotland are in constant need of overseers, attorneys, and skilled tradesmen to manage the daily affairs of our properties overseas. I am sure that we can reach an accommodation to assure you lucrative employment in one of our businesses on that island. Should you choose to cast your fate towards a career in the Indies, we can arrange the appropriate training to refine your combined skills as civil engineer, metallurgical fabricator, and carpenter for the application of this new industrial-based agriculture in the West Indies. Finally, we would strongly advise that you combine all your impressive skills and talents and incorporate to consolidate your strength. Together, you are one formidable force with much potential." Thomas Ingervan replies, "My lord, your counsel has been duly noted. We will heed your sage advice." The group of three plantation owners take leave of the brothers. John says to Thomas, "But that was rather rich. Why this full-scale, fervent pitch for our services? What could their motives be to display such generosity towards such humble folks as you and me. Thomas replies, if we remain in contact with the slave-owning colonial planters of South Asia, going forward, ulterior motives they may reveal. Until then, we accept with grace their flattery. Thomas continues, but brother, we must soon be on our way. No later do we dare delay. We made commitments for the morrow in Maybole. Night comes fast this time of year, and of highwaymen we do have justifiable fear, don't we? John says, brother, you are right. We did run afoul of Jacob, young brigand of your acquaintance, and might we not have suffered his fate had Providence not intervened mercifully on our behalf? Let us leave immediately. Return home. Early afternoon, the low cloud ceiling announces probable precipitation. A chill north wind picks up and sweeps dry leaves from the forest floor and deposits debris generously over the narrow carriage road, that ribbon of unencumbered access through the forest. The brothers harness the horses and mount the carriage and begin the return to Maybole. The horses need little direction, no encouragement. They engage instinctively and enthusiastically with the road. The return home is underway. To avoid the reminder of the scene of the previous attack from the highwayman, the brothers take the road from Ayr by the new bridge Doon at Greenan, Dunduff, Thomason, and Drumbeggs, where it merges onto the great road from Maybole to Girton. They will take the branch leading to Maybole through the farm of Enoch. Thomas intones his drone and recites a fond kiss. Episode 5, The Culzean Experience. Life in rural Ayrshire resumes its normal village tedium for the Ingerman brothers. The family business of carriage construction and repairs and general construction has been struggling as Glasgow comes increasingly to dominate all areas of manufacture, all but eliminating small local workshops serving the farm community. Looking over the records of the business for the first 6 months of the year, Thomas remarks to John. Thomas says, we may have to leave Ayrshire and find employment in Glasgow in the near future, unless we can reverse the losses we're experiencing so far this year. Or we could change our approach and find business beyond the area that we are now serving. Noting an air of discouragement in Thomas, John attempts to introduce some optimism. We may have done ourselves a favour going to the function for Robert Burns. The big shots of South Ayrshire were well represented at the Carriage Inn. Deep pockets from plantation of the West Indies are financing many projects in the country. How do we get access in our business to some of the profits from the slave trade, John wonders. The visit to Ayr for the encomium for Robbie Burns has indeed exposed the brothers to a world beyond the confines of rural Scotland. A curiosity begins to grow about the power, prestige, and wealth at the disposal of the absentee Ayrshire owners of plantation in the West Indies. The curiosity becomes a contagion, and in April, the contagion becomes a fever when they receive an invitation from Lord Kennedy of Culzean for a commission to design and fabricate a pumping system composed of a pond, a stream, a fountain, and waterfalls for the decorative walled gardens being developed at Culzean Castle. John will go to Culzean to assess the feasibility of the project and give a cost estimate to the managers of the castle. John takes leave of Thomas, mounts his carriage, and at daybreak begins his journey to Culzean. The fog rolls back as the light rolls in. The sun shines bright as his trip begins. Best watch out for the highwayman, says Thomas to his younger kin. And take good care of your trusty mare. They say there's angry spirits over there in Kirkoswald. John laughs as his brothers tease. He leans forward and taps his horse's rump with his whip. The carriage leaves for Culzean. John sings while travelling the road from Maybole to Girvan. An invigorating ambience early this July morning breathes radiance, freshness and warmth, a hint of a far-off, tropically indolent afternoon to come, a suggestion of brief, unsustainable physical comfort in blustery coastal North Atlantic, a promise impossible to realize in coastal Scotland, where a brief summer will soon give way to a perennially enduring chill. His spirits high, John sings praises to this morning while in transit through these South Ayrshire landscapes. But is he fully aware of the fragility of summer and the transitory, fickle nature of life and of love? John sings Westland Winds by Robert Burns. Absorbed in his serenade, John is startled out of his musical trance and forced to re-engage actively with his carriage journey to Culzean when his horse breaks stride and momentarily veers off the roadway. John pulls sharply on the reins to regain command of the animal and stops the carriage. They are in the village of Kirkoswald. The suddenly recalcitrant horse remains quite agitated. John dismounts and strokes its neck, speaks gently to the animal, coaxing. While stroking it, he walks a short distance alongside the animal while it becomes increasingly more compliant. 100 meters later, the horse regains its composure. John continues his journey, Kirkoswald to Maidens, Maidens to Culzean. Culzean sparkles in morning sunshine as John's carriage makes a gradual descent and passes in front of a grand mansion perched imperiously on a cliff over the Firth of Clyde. Episode 6, Scipio, at Culzean Castle. At the gated entrance, a boy walks a short distance to tell the gatekeeper that a carriage has just arrived, and Mr. John Ingarvan of Ingarvan Brothers in Maybole is here by appointment. The gatekeeper addresses Ingarvan.
Good morning, Mr. Ingarvan. Welcome to Culzean. I'm given to understand that you are here in response to a commission from Lord Kennedy. Your punctuality this early morn is remarkable. You must have risen with the dawn. How was your journey from Maybole?
John replies, Sire, it was indeed a beautiful morn for travel. At break of day, a spreading mist with shafts of light infused and bathed the land with a radiant glow. All went well until the passage through Kirkoswald. My faithful horse, as gentle a mount as can be found, taken by a sudden urge to rebel against my wishes, left the roadway, and without my stern command, would have taken the carriage to ground and done me in. A frightful end to a pleasant beginning was the prospect for my journey. The gatekeeper replies, Some say there are angry spirits over there in Kirkoswald. One of the servants of Culzean, a woman descended from the line of an African slave, will tell you of her ancestor who lived and served 50 years as faithful servants in this self-same castle. He continues, Follow the road behind the castle. The liveryman will take your carriage and show you to the servants' hall. There you'll find Grace, granddaughter of Scipio Kennedy, the African, who spent his life in service to Kennedy's
of Culzean. Grace lives in Kirkoswald's and knows the story of Scipio, the displaced phantom of Culzean. Inside the castle, John is led to the servants' hall and interrupts the busy daily kitchen routine. He's greeted by the butler. "Young man, we have a tight schedule in this facility. We can ill afford to interrupt the staff at this time. Grace Kennedy will be able to see you very briefly for a few moments at 10 o'clock, after the breakfast has been served and the dining hall put back in order. Thereafter, preparations will be underway for lunch service. Did you hear me say very briefly, young man?"
Yes, sir, I understand," John says sheepishly.
At 10 a.m. precisely, a brown-skinned woman of a certain age emerges from the servants' hall, her tight, curly brown hair visible from under a blue bonnet, shows streaks of gray. She addresses John.
"Good morning, sir. I was informed that you wished to speak to me. Who are you and what do you want of me?"
"My name is John Ingervan of Maybole. I was told that you are a descendant of an African man who lived and served in this castle some time ago."
"Of what possible importance is my ancestry to you, sir?" Grace answers defensively.
I apologize to you, ma'am, and understand that what I say may appear foolish, but on my way from Maybole to Culzean this morning, my carriage was nearly upended by the behavior of my horse. It seemed to have become suddenly deranged on my passage through Kirkoswald, as if possessed and inhabited by some unseen force. It refused to proceed until I walked beside it and guided it some distance from the churchyard."
"Oh, that nonsense again, Phantom of Culzean," the chambermaid says impatiently.
"And for that poppycock, you interrupt my morning's work? Let me tell you, sir," she says. "My grandfather Scipio Africanus was a man of extraordinary quality. He was trained and worked in the textile industry, was an accomplished butler in the castle, and was respected and admired by the Kennedy family, so much so that he was given the Kennedy name and included in the will of the wife of the Marquis of Cassilis. My grandfather Scipio Kennedy had his own residence on the grounds of Culzean Castle. He died and was buried there. The fact that he is now interred in the cemetery in Kirkoswald, put there by his son, my Uncle Douglas, after my grandfather's residence was demolished, gives some people the idiotic idea that he's still trying to get back to his home there. Utter nonsense. Superstition, I say. My dead grandfather is not now a restless ghost bothering horses on the roadway. Let him be. Let him rest in peace. Now, Mr. Ingervan, I will take my leave of you to get back to my duties." She departs. Having already spent 2 hours surveying the terrain around Culzean, taking notes and making measurements for the garden project while waiting for Grace, John leaves to return to Maybole, somewhat chastened by Scipio's granddaughter. One last look back from his carriage discloses the grandeur of Culzean on display above the vast blue expanse of the Firth of Clyde, where shifting spikes of light sparkle and dance over the water under the noonday sun. On the road back to Maybole, Ingervan stops a good distance from the cemetery at Kirkoswald, leaves his horse tethered to a tree, and walks among the stone markers of graves. While reading the inscription on Scipio Kennedy's headstone, the displaced phantom of Culzean appears from behind the monument to relate his story. In rapt attention, John is witness to the displaced phantom standing behind the headstone. The phantom of Culzean addresses Ingervan in the guise of and with the voice of a child, but with wisdom gained from his 80 years of life. Scipio Kennedy, the displaced phantom of Culzean, tells his story to John. Ingervan, Episode 7, The Decision. John says to Thomas, "Brother, the castle is grand indeed. My journey to Culzean was most pleasant, though in truth I must report a most uncanny encounter with a spectre they call the displaced phantom of Culzean. After my initial shock at this apparition in broad daylight, I was moved to take note of the story that the displaced phantom told of his life in our region, the essence of which I will now recount." John relates Scipio's tale to his brothers Thomas and young brother William. He says, "You forewarned me about the strange behavior of horses in Kirkoswald. I was subject to the apparition of an African, dead now nearly 50 years, a man called Scipio, abducted from Africa as a child and taken to Jamaica, bought from slavers by an Ayrshire man, Douglas of Garelian, brought to Ayrshire and given to his daughter as dowry on her marriage to Lord Kennedy of Culzean. Scipio served the Culzean estate for over 60 years before his death. His home on Culzean estate was demolished after his death and replaced by a walled garden. Some say that he has been seeking to return to his abode at Culzean ever since his remains were disturbed and removed from their resting place and placed in the cemetery in Kirkoswald. Although his granddaughter, a strange, abrasive woman, wanted nothing to do with the story of Scipio's ghost, I experienced his presence and was witness to the spectre at his gravesite in Kirkoswald." Thomas says, "I had heard rumors of strange incidents in that district, but never gave much credence to the rumors. What are we to make of your encounter with the apparition of an African man, dead nearly 50 years, who returns as an 80-year-old child?" Thomas asked rhetorically. "The inexplicable will have to remain unexplained," John concludes. "However, I can report on the results of my consultation with the manager of Culzean about the landscaping work that they requested. The commission from Culzean for our services will require that we design a system to irrigate the kitchen gardens from water in the existing Swan Pond, and that we add a decorative fountain near an orchard. The management of the castle appears to have plans for a fairly important addition to the castle grounds in the near future to complement a recent addition to the gardens at Culzean, a pheasant tree. The fountain addition to the ornate garden will require wind-driven pumping machines to move water from the Swan Pond. To design and implement the elements of that project, your ability as a civil engineer will come into play, my brother. A final surprise for you. Listen to this. A consortium of absentee planters under the auspices of the Earl of Cassilis has offered us employment on a few plantations in Jamaica. We will be hired to maintain machinery for two plantations, one in Clarendon, the other in St. Anne. We must also supervise road maintenance in the area between the parishes of Clarendon and St. Anne and explore the possibility of purchasing or developing a coffee plantation in the parish of St. Thomas. This latter task will appeal to you, Thomas, being declared already a saint without even having to die to merit the title." John laughs. "We have also been offered the cost of passage, 30 guineas, wines included. The annual salary is already attractive enough, but the inclusion of the cost of travel certainly should tip the balance in favor of giving it a try. We will be expanding our networks of future contacts as we go into this venture, and if all else fails, we will elevate our status and have many stories to tell our neighbors if and when we return to Ayrshire." January 25th, 1825, Robbie Burns Day, Thomas and John decide to travel to break the news of their decision to leave Ayrshire and take employment in Jamaica to his mother, to their younger brother, William, cousins in the area of the coastal town of Girvan, and to John's lover, Anne Gray, at the family home. Thomas addresses his widowed mother, Mary, younger brother, William, and cousins. Thomas says, We're happy to announce that John and I have offers for employment in the West Indies from a consortium of plantation owners in our district. We will use our training to supervise the maintenance of roads and machinery already in use on two existing sugar plantations and design and build structures for a coffee plantation in Jamaica. The prospects at this time seem to favor coffee, since sugar production has peaked and is now in decline. We anticipate that we will leave Scotland in early May to begin this exciting adventure. We have only 3 months to wrap up business in Maybole and prepare for a new life in the West Indies. The decision to leave is taken not without regrets. We take this decision knowing that we are leaving the people, the scenes, the landscapes, and the habits of our youth and childhood. And yet, the temptation to pursue the potential rewards of a lucrative and prosperous future seems compelling enough to risk going beyond the familiar. We have sold our place in Maybole along with the workshop and machinery. The proceeds of this sale gives us enough money to set up a business in Jamaica in an area where there are many plantations which need services which John and I possess, engineering and trades needed for the manufacture and maintenance of the machinery for the production of sugar and rum and coffee. John will keep his place, the manse, in Maybole, which we could develop further if and when we return to Ayrshire. At a going-away party, Thomas, John, and relatives sing Auld Lang Syne. Episode 8, Atlantic Crossing. Thomas and John depart May 20th, 1825, from Greenock on the Calypso bound for Jamaica. The Calypso slips silently into daybreak, leaving the dock at Greenock under full sails. Morning sun is revealing progressively a brightening landscape, rolling away the shadows of dawn, spreading light, while spreading a Maytime spring onto the wakening city. Thomas and John watch together as the distance between their past and their now evolving future widens behind billowing sails, trying to hold back the fears of departure by envisaging the promise of their new life. "What are you feeling right now, brother?" Thomas says, his arm over his brother's shoulder. "Not quite sure. A bit of regret, a bit of excitement, and maybe a few fears, I suppose."
I can understand the regret and the excitement, but what are your fears?" Thomas asks.
"Well, for one, the language. How are we going to communicate with the people in Jamaica? And over 60 days at sea, away from terra firma, does seem a bit risky. How do we deal with mal de mer? There's no turning back, is there?"
"Listen," Thomas says, "as technical service people looking after the machinery, the buildings and the roads, we will communicate almost always with white people, and if we have to address the staves, we can go through the more experienced senior white employees, bookkeepers and attorneys, until we learn the lingo. As for seasickness, we will cross that bridge when we get there, if we get there," Thomas replies reassuringly. As the boat loses sight of land, Thomas and John descend to their cramped communal living quarters where they will pass the next 2 months of their lives. "If you want to learn how to pray, go to sea," says a Portuguese dictum. "Leaving Britain the first week of the 6,000 nautical mile transatlantic voyage from Britain to Jamaica is relatively easy sailing. The next 2 weeks present variable conditions, a few days of squalls and gusty winds, when progress is relatively slow. Hours of boredom follow, punctuated by moments of sheer terror, where wind and water conspire to tear the boat apart." John continues to express his fears and insecurities to Thomas.
Nearing a month in the ocean, he says, we seem at times to be drifting aimlessly, as if lost, unsure of our destination. Despite the crowded living quarters we now have on board, I haven't really imagined the sensation of isolation from the earth, and especially from vegetation, those things that used to anchor our daily lives. I am now discovering that I am a hopeless landlubber. Nearing a month on the ocean means that we are close to halfway to our destination, Thomas says. Take heart, brother. Sailing ships have been navigating these waters for more than 1,000 years. Despite Thomas's optimism, John comes increasingly to the realization that his cross is Rubicon. Unable to sleep, John leaves his bunk and moves silently to the upper deck to escape the ever-present odors from human waste and the disinfection used to neutralize the smell of human waste. Sailing under a starless sky, the world outside on the deck assumes the shape of a suffocating black dome covering the moving vessel. With no points of reference, John experiences a subtle sensation of claustrophobia in an environment of open air. He returns to his sleeping quarters. There he falls asleep with his fears unresolved, and he muses as he dreams. Six weeks into the adventure, the discomforts of a continuing claustrophobia in the living quarters below decks kicks in. Thomas and John have a continuing discussion about the journey, the elements of which involve the deteriorating quality of the food and the discomforts from the smells rising from the lavatory and the incessant noises. In the midst of discussion, a solitary voice cries, "Dolphins off the starboard bow!" "Dolphins off the starboard bow!" repeats another voice. Passengers and crew emerge from below and assemble on the deck to witness a school of divine aquatic creatures flying, dipping, gliding in unison, skimming through and atop the water. Over 50 dolphins frolic beside the vessel, bringing all the passengers out to marvel at the spectacle. The fish are visible for a few glorious minutes, then leave the boat in their wake, their absence highlighted by a vanishing area of frothy water disappearing into the horizon. "In a great hurry, aren't they?" says a young man among the passengers gathered to see the dolphin display from the main deck. He is accompanied by a very attractive, dark-skinned young woman. "I am James, James Tom from Ayrshire, Scotland." "In a hurry indeed," John replies. "There must be some celebration of the summer solstice in Dolphinland to mark June 21st. Mustn't be late or you'll miss all the fun." "A pleasure to meet you, James. I am John Ingarvan, and my brother here is Thomas." "What a coincidence. We also hail from Ayrshire, South Ayrshire, Maybole. Where does your family reside?" "Tarbolton. I have had a long and happy association with that community. Let me introduce you to my wife," James says to Thomas and John. "We were married 6 months ago in Jamaica. Elizabeth expressed an interest in seeing my birthplace, so this trip is our belated honeymoon to introduce my new wife to the charms of South Ayrshire while engaging in some business affairs for the owners of the plantation where I work as an attorney." "A pleasure to meet you, Mom," Tom addresses Elizabeth. "How are you enjoying your honeymoon voyage? I must say that your honeymoon trip reverses the normal flow of travel, where we people of the chilly north go to regions of warm weather for leisure and enjoyment." "I have indeed enjoyed my time in South Ayrshire," Elizabeth replies. "For James, no leisure, just necessary work. I relied on his many siblings and cousins to show me the charms of South Ayrshire while he was busy with the affairs of the plantation." They enter the Sargasso Sea. 7 weeks into the Atlantic crossing, they reach the vicinity of the horse latitudes, the Sargasso Sea and Bermuda Triangle. The weather becomes increasingly erratic. A prolonged two-day period of calm finds the boat surrounded by floating masses of seaweed. A period of squalls follows, blustery winds and pelting rain. Calm returns to the doldrums, a deeper, more silent calm, an ominous, alarming calm. The Calypso is disabled for lack of wind. The British ensign hangs limp on its mast. A series of floating masses of seaweed surround the ship. At sunset, passengers emerge muttering from their cabins. Night falls, apprehension mounts. "Good night, John," Thomas says to his brother. "By morning, we'll be on our way again." John's nightmare, Zong. John's sleep is at first fitful. The deep, abiding calm, difficult to process after 5 weeks of incessant noise from wind, rain, and ocean, and from the wooden structural members of the boat. He falls into a troubled sleep, punctuated by moans and mumbles. Thomas is awakened by John's distress and tries to calm his brother. Among the confused groans, Thomas thinks that he hears the word song. He rests his hands on John's head, moist with sweat. John becomes calm and falls back into a deeper sleep of peace. The Calypso is now passing the Atlantic Gyre, zone of absolute calm in the North Atlantic Ocean, where a massive growth of sargassum circulates continuously. The mass of seaweed is trapped in the area of the gyre, a great pubic zone in the ocean circulating around a mysterious vaginal entrance way to a promise, but also a peril of unfathomable but extraordinary submarine pleasures. In a lucid erotic dream, John populates the zone of the Atlantic gyre with lithe brown-scaled mermaids striped longitudinally with three golden scaled stripes. The sirens try to reassure him that he's on the right path to his destiny. They sing their serenade. In your mind. During the night, the pilot adjusts the ship's bearing in an effort to avoid being further becalmed. He directs the sails in a more southeasterly direction. The maneuver is successful, and at dawn passengers are comforted by the sight of sails bulging with winds. Southerly at first, then westerly, and with increasing warmth. They have found the North Atlantic Equatorial Current, westerly conveyor belt from the mid-Atlantic to the Caribbean. "Good morning, brother," Thomas greets his brother. "The spell is broken. The wicked wizard of the doldrums has lost his power to suspend the ocean currents and block circulation in the atmosphere. Until this morning, I feared that we might have been stuck there in the Atlantic gyre, circling endlessly until our supplies exhausted, we set upon each other in a desperate struggle to survive. You had a fitful sleep last night, brother. A few episodes of nightmares." "I had a recurring dream," John says. "I was aware that, mercifully, you interrupted one of my nightmares. My mind must have visited that wretched Sunday morning service where Thomas Clarkson, the abolitionist, had a seizure and lost consciousness in front of the congregation in air after the function for Robbie Burns." "Aha, the Zong," Thomas says, "the slave ship." "Let it be, please," says John. "The nightmare is over. What a glorious morning." "Can you imagine this morning in Maybole?" Thomas counters as they walk together up the ramp to the main deck. Several small groups are already on the deck, chatting. John engages with a young man he met on deck when the school of dolphins were passing the ship. "Good morning, James. What a relief it is to be making headway towards Jamaica after wasting time treading water in the harsh latitude for close to a week." "Good morning, John. Relief indeed. Until this morning, I had been seriously thinking about cancelling our passage to Jamaica in mid-sailing and waiting at the carriage stop for the next carriage heading for air," Jane says, tongue-in-cheek. "The Ayrshire countryside will be in full bloom by now.
wild daisies in abundance, heather, corn marigold, wild marjoram, yarrow, clover, a riot of color and pollen for happy insects to harvest. We seem to have survived the worst part of the transatlantic journey, and here we are in what promises to be paradise. If today's any indication of what lies ahead, I can say adieu without hesitation to the banks of Ayr, an enthusiastic bonjour to the Bank of England, John quips. Later today, we can drink a toast to our promising future in Jamaica, if the reserves of spirits are not yet exhausted from our passage, wines included. Looking forward to that, compatriot, John replies. The relaxed social encounter and the spirits in a bottle relieve the passengers of the prolonged tension for over 7 weeks of concern in a frail vessel against the mighty elements of wind and ocean. The passengers are expansive in their outlook, some inebriated and giddy in conversation, others in small groups praying silently in thanks for the protection of the Almighty and deliverance from the crushing anxiety of transoceanic travel. On the horizon, off the starboard side of the boat, they pass a large landmass which the crew identify as the island of Puerto Rico. 5 days to go, John announces to the others in his group, his speech slurred from rum, which has now replaced the dwindling stock of wines included in the price of passage. Late afternoon, sun gives way at first to a layer of high, thin, twisted, ribbon-like clouds stretching away from the stern of the boat. A gray overcast sky darkens an area to the wake of the boat. The revelers disperse from the upper deck to the living quarters, anticipating turbulence. Taking his leave of James and Elizabeth, John remarks sarcastically, "It appears that even paradise has its moments of disturbance." One ear-splitting crack of thunder, followed by cascading peals of thunder, prolonged rumblings rolling away across a darkening sky, a repeated and sustained timpani percussion, punctuated by a kaleidoscope of refracting and rotating rainbows, water droplets being split and reconstructed, release their latent energy while filtering the rays of the sun. A few violent gusts of wind whip the British ensign attached to the mizzen mast and tug against the fabric of the flag, shredding its edges, then ripping the flag into three pieces. A few small holes in the thickening cloud cover reveal the ensign tattered and torn as the Calypso, pushed by gusting winds, races into a setting sun. Torn, tattered, ragged, bruised, and battered, Britannia rules the waves. Tailwinds generated by fast-approaching Santa Ana hurricane push the Calypso westward from Puerto Rico. The 5 days to arrival estimated by the crew is reduced considerably, and the transatlantic crossing reaches the destination, Kingston, Jamaica, July 25, 1825. The Calypso pulls alongside the dock. Passengers emerge from below and touch land for the very first time in over 60 days. From the deck, the assembled passengers hear a dock worker shouting an address to them. The dock worker says,
"Uno lucky, you know. Me no know if uno hear that hurricane mash up like Puerto Rico. Bunch of people them dead and broke up all of them people them house, you know."
Another worker interrupts,
"Look, you know, master, them not going to stand what you say. You have to talk slow and don't try to open up your mouth."
"Even paradise has its inconvenience," John repeats to Thomas. "What language were those dock workers speaking? What did they say?" "They were speaking in Patois, Jamaica's evolving language," James's wife Elizabeth says. "One of the workers said that we were lucky to have escaped a hurricane which struck Puerto Rico yesterday, killing thousands of people and leveling most of the structures on the island. The other told his co-worker to speak more slowly to make us understand what he was saying." "Even paradise has its inconveniences," John remarks. "It appears that we have some work to do to make ourselves understood in this new paradise."